Good evening. James McCanny here with my Science Hour, September 20th, 2012. Wow, this year is just flying by. Tonight I will be talking about that very issue, the issue of time and calendars. I'm going to go deeper into this topic so that people out there will understand what we're dealing with when we talk about time and calendars. And a very difficult topic. What would happen if you lost time? Our watches, our calendars, everything is there. You go on a computer, your telephone. You have all types of sources of information to give you time and scheduling and calendars, etc. But if that were lost, if that went away, that'd be an interesting experiment, just a little home experiment. Everybody leave their watch, leave their phone. Don't look at it for a weekend. Say you go on a camping trip or you go on a vacation. Don't look at your watch or any timepiece for a few days. And just watch how quickly time and the date and everything escapes you. And after about 2 or 3 days or 4 days, if possible, talk with the people in your group and say, what day is it? What time is it? And just try and get opinions. And the farther out in time you go, the more variation in opinions you would get. So at any rate, I'll be talking more about calendars and the very complex nature of this. Now, a woman emailed in and she said, you know, I listen to your show and it's very complicated. I don't understand all that you're talking about, but this is kind of the point. This is very complex stuff. And for people to understand it, a lot of people, even if they took a class detailed for a whole semester, would not be able to master all of the innuendos of our time and calendars, the way we clock things using the stars and the sun and how the moon plays into this. All of these are different timepieces, and they kind of all mesh together in kind of a loose-knit network of timing, but it's very complicated. So here's what I want to tell people. That's why I invented the WeCalendar Sunstar clock. It takes all of the magic and mystery out of this. What you do, basically, and what the ancients did is they just tracked the sun. What was the sun doing? What were the stars doing? And that's something that you can do quite simply. It can get very complicated, but I've taken a lot of the mystery and complication out of this so that anybody can basically understand. I gave an example last week on the show. I said, if you go fishing with, say, a spin cast reel, it'll take you a while to get adept at casting and reeling back in and catching a fish, for example. It's all somewhat complicated. But to do that, you do not need to know everything, all of the gears and mechanisms in that rather complex little device we call a spinning reel, the thing that you reel the fish in with. In fact, probably most fishermen don't know all of the ins and outs of their own fishing reel. Some might, but that's a relatively simple little device compared to a calendar. So the point is that for those people that think they're kind of lost, well, you're in good company, because a lot of people out there are lost regarding calendars and time. In fact, a lot of people who think they're specialists are lost in this subject, and they don't know where they're going. They think they can extrapolate calendars out thousands and thousands of years into the past, and it's not true. So anyway, it's a complex topic, but as I said, the reason I invented the Star WeCalendar Sunstar clock was that it gives you a device, very simple device, although it contains a lot of complex background information, which allows you to recalendar. And so anyway, this topic of calendars, this will be my third week really concentrating on this topic. But tonight I'm going to go deeper into the topic of what happens if we have a pole shift. And I'm talking about a physical pole shift where something big comes by and twists the planet. The planet gets flipped on its axis physically. And I'm not talking about a magnetic pole shift. A magnetic pole shift is just where our magnetic north pole gets adjusted. In fact, today, this morning, I was monitoring the sun, getting ready for the show, and it's something I do on a daily basis. I monitor the sun activity, the solar wind near Earth, and other readings of around the solar system. But we had a fairly significant magnetic reversal today. And so that means that our magnetic pole shifted. It actually went to zero because the local solar wind magnetic field was opposite of our own geomagnetic field, what we call our geomagnetic field, although much of that is built by plasma, by electrical currents in outer space around the Earth. But the solar wind magnetic field that was rushing by Earth reversed our magnetic field. So we have pole shifts. We have magnetic pole shifts all the time. And they occur quite frequently. But physical pole shifts, you don't want to know about it. You don't want to be in one. Believe me, that would rock your socks, and most people would probably not live through it, because what would have to happen is a large object would have to come by. And I want to break into a little story here, because I don't want to forget about it. It's something that happened to me about a month and a half ago. I regularly get called to be on interviews and to give expert opinion, etc. A major glossy magazine editorial department called me up, and I'm not going to say which one, because what happens if I do, then all of there's a lot of nutcases out there that would jump up and down and try and run and call up the editors and things like that. And so anyway, I don't want to save that particular obnoxious behavior. So I'm not going to say which glossy magazine, but I assure you it's something that all of you have read and all of you have seen. But anyway, the editorial staff called me up, and it was kind of a young woman's voice who was working there, and after I talked with her for a while, I could tell she was about as green could be. But at any rate, they asked me if I would talk about pole shifts and be on a television special that they were going to produce. And so I thought, well, sure, I'll give this a shot and see what... she wanted to ask a few questions, and so she said, we are mainly concentrating on magnetic pole shifts, and she wanted to know if I thought that a magnetic pole shift would come and destroy Earth or have any drastic effects on Earth. And I said, young lady, magnetic pole shifts happen all the time, and we live through them, and nobody really even knows it. But I said, the real pole shift you should be talking about is the physical pole shift, where something comes by, and she goes in. I could tell, this is the funny part, I could tell she was talking with her editor in the background, so they must have had a speakerphone, and she was doing the talking, and he must have been giving her hand signals or something. And she goes, well, yeah, we don't really want to cover that topic. We just want to know about the magnetic pole shifts and what you think if there's going to be Earth disaster due to magnetic pole shifts. And I said, wait, you don't understand. I'm not going to go on a show and cater to some biased question, like in a biased survey, and talk about a limited topic and not talk about the real issues. So they didn't want to hear about that. They only wanted to talk about the magnetic pole shifts. And so then I started to smell kind of a rotten fish in Denmark, that possibly they were trying to set me up. And so the typical thing that I do is I tell them that I would not be on a show unless I understand who's going to be on it and where they're going with this. I'm not going to get ambushed on some crummy television special produced by some people that, and this young lady obviously was green, had no idea what she was talking about, had no idea what the total topic is out here in the real world. All she knew is that her editor had told her to call up and ask me to be on a program about magnetic pole shifts. So then, as the story progressed, they really didn't want to talk to me because I didn't want to talk. They wouldn't let me talk about the real issues. They only wanted to talk about magnetic pole shifts. So back to today's magnetic pole shift, it was a perfect example of a pole shift that occurs on a daily basis, a magnetic pole shift. Everybody lived through it. I'm not aware of anybody who died from it. It's just a reversal of the magnetic field. And what does happen is we get an extra blast of radiation. The solar wind that normally gets blocked by our magnetic field, the high energy particles coming off of the sun in the solar wind, are buffeted and pushed aside by our magnetic field. The electrons go one way, the protons and the positively charged ions go the other way, and so that blocks Earth from this radiation, particle radiation basically. And so when the magnetic field reverses, and I talk about this in my weather book and the other books also, that when the magnetic field reverses, the charged particles then are free to come in and hit the surface of the Earth's atmosphere, the upper atmosphere, and causes severe X-ray radiation. A planet like Venus has no protective magnetic field, and therefore it has constantly X-rays and high-energy ultraviolet light, etc., on the sunward side and up high in its atmosphere. So, but Earth is protected from with our magnetic field and typically does not. So we had a little extra blast of radiation this morning. And by the way, I've talked for the last few weeks that we were in that kind of zero solar wind zone through the month of August. That's the typical August return current sheet. And we had been seeing a lot of turbulence in the solar wind over the last couple weeks, and that's an indication that we are moving out of that August return current sheet. That's the return current sheet that comes from the far reaches of the solar system, balances the solar wind external or excess current of electric charge that's moving out in the solar wind that causes our electrical solar system to form, the big capacitor that forms in our solar system. And of course, that cannot go on forever, so there has to be a return current sheet, and that comes back to the sun where Earth is in the month of August. That's why we have the hurricane peak then, that's why we have the aurora peak season in August, and that's why we have the tornado peak season in August. So anyway, we are now in a situation where there's still a bit of turbulence in the solar wind, but we are firmly back in the solar wind coming off the sun and out of the August return current sheet, which blows in the other direction, causing basically a zero solar wind pressure. It's like a garden hose. If you just cut the pressure back to zero, something still would be coming out of the hose possibly, but at a very weak pressure. And that's what happens with the solar wind when we're in that return current sheet. The current sheet opposes the solar wind, and so it's a time when we can get some fairly significant weather results from that. So at any rate, just mentioning that we did have a solar magnetic pole reversal. The solar wind caused this, and this morning, although, as I say, nothing to really put on a lead helmet about. And I just wanted to include that little factor, that little story about the major glossy news magazine that wanted to produce a TV special using my name, but they wanted to twist the story, and I wasn't about to let them do that using my name, my information. And so it's kind of funny. Now they don't want to talk. They just kind of don't want to talk about it. And these people are so humorous because the poor little lady, she was just doing her little job there, editor, you know, probably first year or second year novice editor at a magazine. And it was so comical because the editor himself, herself, whoever, would not call me directly, but had this nouveau, inexperienced person call, sitting back while they talked to me, and then giving hand signals, which was very obvious during the phone conversation. So anyway, life in the big city. I want to switch the topic a little bit to cancer. I've been talking about this on a show recently, and I have a friend who now is in a assisted living type of place. It's kind of like a halfway, I don't know what you'd call it, a place where people are ill, but they're not really in the hospital because the hospital is not doing anything for them. And so anyway, some friends had sent some dried Osage orange apples. And this is something that people eat. I mean, you can go and pick one off a tree and eat it. And so they sent it to him because this is something that has an effect on cancer, to see if they could pull him out. This person has cancer and has been diagnosed with cancer, although I'm starting to think that he has an infection and not cancer, but that's another topic. Been misdiagnosed. But at any rate, his friends had sent him some Osage orange apples. Osage orange is a tree that grows in the American Southwest. And so anyway, the apples from that are said to possess properties that can, I don't know if you'd call it cure cancer, but reduce or help the person with cancer. They wouldn't let him eat the apples. They took them away. They came in the mail. They wouldn't allow him to take these apples and eat them. And so apparently the people called up and says, what's the problem here? It's, oh, well, no, we can't. We don't know about these unless they're FDA approved. Well, first of all, the FDA is not going to approve an apple. They're not going to do a study on homeopathic herbal, if you would call it herbal, medicines. They have no interest. They have no financial incentive to do any studies on anything, especially related to cancer, that might work. The only game in town that will ever be the game in town regarding cancer in the official medical world is chemo and radiation. It's the cash cow that keeps the medical industry going. We did an analysis on the medical industry, and it becomes very obvious if it were not for cancer treatments with chemo and radiation, the medical industry would fold. So don't ever expect a cure for cancer to come out of anything, because it's just too big a financial cash cow for the medical industry to cure cancer or to find something, especially something that's as simple as an apple that grows on a tree. So at any rate, that's the ongoing story. I'll keep you posted on that. But it's becoming clear that these people in these businesses, can you imagine their business would go to zero if, in fact, there was a simple, can you imagine a simple remedy for cancer that was that simple, just eat an apple from a certain tree? But no, that's pretty dangerous. Now imagine how ridiculous this situation is. Here is a person who's been diagnosed with terminal cancer, has months to live, but they don't want him to eat that apple. It could be dangerous. Do you see how absurd, how absolutely absurd this is? And so it's obviously very clear They're only protecting their industry because if people started eating Osage orange apples and becoming cured from cancer, how in walking out of these facilities, they'd be out of business. Okay, switching topics. I was a guest last Friday night, I believe it was Friday night, on Coast to Coast AM, first hour, giving a commentary on the sun and also about the object that hit Jupiter. And I get a kick out of NASA. They're looking at Jupiter, trying to look for remnants of the little asteroid that hit Jupiter, causing an explosion, and a vast explosion that would be the equivalent of many, many, many nuclear bombs. But you have to understand the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, there are many, many aerosols, and so it's very rarefied. And so if an asteroid came in, it would just burrow into that, and you would never see anything. So once again, Tier 2 fairy tale science couldn't possibly be true. Mother Goose has a lot more truth in her fairy tales than NASA science. But Nori asked me about that when I was on the show, in addition to the commentary on the sun. And he started out by asking, he said, "Jim, you know, the sun has been very quiet, quiescent lately. What's going on?" And so, yeah, it has been. The sun has been extremely quiet. We are heading into a new solar cycle, but you wouldn't know about it if you look at places like spaceweather.com. Then you would, whenever there's a little bit of an aurora up by the North Pole someplace, they write about it like it's the biggest thing since sliced bread ever came along. And the reality is, I'm a person who likes to watch auroras when I'm in the northern climate, farther north. And that we haven't had any for years. We have not had auroras that dip down into what you'd call the mid-latitudes, the, you know, 45 degrees north latitude and thereabouts. Usually you should see a few of them per summer. And in very dark places like North Dakota, you can see them almost every night of the year, but we haven't had any, not any, for years. So at any rate, the sun is extremely quiet. That's all I can tell you. There's a new book out. Somebody wrote in, a listener, and said, "Wow, there's a new book out, Velikovsky, something about Velikovsky." And I just looked at it enough to realize that this guy is, whoever wrote this, and I'm not going to even mention a name because it's not worth reading, very cursory analysis, didn't reference anybody that's done work previously, and comes up with a lot of false conclusions. And my take on it was that this is just misinformation, the disinfo crew putting out a book that would be an easy target for the Velikovsky opponents, the Tier 2 scientists that you see running around the internet or representing NASA. And so it's a little dog and pony show where somebody comes out, defends Velikovsky with really cursory analysis that is bogus, and then sets up an easy target for the Tier 2 scientists to come riding in to save the day. So not worth more mention than just that. Just a quick mention on the turmoil in the Mideast. And now you have Japan and China going at it. It's very clear, folks. The CIA and the Mossad and the other agencies out there that cause trouble in the world are busy, busy at work. But it turned out, this is what I wanted to talk about here, is that it turns out that the protesters in Egypt and Syria and some of the other places that have been kind of going crazy lately against U.S. embassies, etc., were paid. These people were paid to jump up and down and act crazy and hold up signs and, you know, where are these people going to get signs that are written in perfect English? You know, somebody is providing this. It's like Hollywood is creating the news, and then the politicians respond like, "Oh, we have all of these political turmoil around the world." And it's just the old protection racket. you know, create a problem and then solve it, and that makes you important. And I just wanted to make a little political commentary. I'm sure everybody who listens to me out there knows I'm not a Republican or a Democrat or anything. This dog and pony show that they call elections is just a farce. But I've kind of noted all along that Romney, in my opinion, just analyzing the dog and pony show, was just been a straw horse set up to lose. And of course, his goal was to take away Ron Paul from the Republican Party and put somebody else there. But Obama is the little new world boy, and he's doing their job. So why would they get rid of him? He's doing everything they want. And so, you know, Romney is there just to occupy space to make the appearance of an election and controversial issues. Really, there's a good YouTube video that shows Obama saying something, then Romney saying something, and they're 100% the same. And the only issue is that when they're in office, all kinds of other things are going on that they don't talk about in the election. But a lot of people are fooled. The American public is so easily fooled, it's pathetic. But, okay, on to the next subject. The Grail mission from NASA is now monitoring the moon. There are two space probes that are orbiting the moon, and they're doing an analysis of the density of the moon, which is basically related to the gravitational field of the moon. So they're mapping very exactly, much more exact than previously, the density of our moon. And so at any rate, here's the part I wanted to stress, that apparently the principal investigator, name is Maria Zuber, sounds like a nice tier two scientist for NASA, was giving a interview for Nature magazine, who is apparently is going to publish some results from this. But they started asking this Maria Zuber some questions about the results. And so anyway, her comment was that Grail results have not been published or released publicly by NASA, and so Zuber was not at liberty to give an interview on the results of the Grail mission, the two satellites that are orbiting in the moon. And so my comment is that this is very typical of NASA. A few years ago, the head of NASA came out and said they were going to have an openness policy. Scientists would certainly be able to raise their opinion. And that was as a result of many scientists within NASA complaining that their analysis, their discussion of the so-called global warming issue was being modified or let's say, edited before it got outside of NASA. And NASA goes, we are open. We publish all of our data, and our scientists are free to talk. Well, obviously, they are not. And here's another great example that shows that scientists from NASA simply cannot walk up to a microphone and start talking. Everything is scripted. Everything is pre-filtered. And the scientists are not. Let me repeat. Scientists at NASA are not at liberty to talk. And so if there's the point, if they cannot talk about data from the planet Mercury or from the planet Moon, from our moon, and data is as simple as the density of the moon, I mean, I don't really think that has much to do with national security, but if they're not at liberty to talk about something that mundane, they certainly are not at liberty to talk about Planet X or any topics like that. So this idea that NASA is open and those scientists, there are people that have said, oh, if NASA scientists knew about Planet X, they would certainly tell you. No, they can't. They're under gag orders. As part of NASA, they cannot just walk up to a microphone and start talking. And so what does NASA have? They have a bunch of Tier 3 blogger Trekkies out there that run around the Internet to spout the standard NASA party line. And so that's the method that's being used now for information from NASA. Just another quick comment. There was an article that just came out on the planet Mercury, and it said that Mercury had to form by some different process, a process different than the rest of the planets because of surface composition that has been detected. They have a satellite that's going around that's called MESSENGER, and it's going around the planet Mercury, orbiting, and one of the experiments on board the satellite is a spectrometer experiment that allows them to determine what elements are on the surface. And Mercury is a very dense little planet, a lot of iron in its core, but a lot of sulfur on the surface in patches. And so it turns out that they're saying that this planet Mercury had to form very differently than the other planets. And so, but the point is that it's still, they're still using the idea that it formed within the original group of planets that they say formed billions of years ago. And if you look at these planets, very likely Mercury has been a planet that probably was more recent. Its orbit is elliptical. It has its orbit is off the plane of the planets, off of the plane of Jupiter, and it's just very clear that Mercury, even though it might be an extremely old planet, is not one of the original planets. It was captured just like all the rest of the moons and planets of the solar system, with the Sun and Jupiter probably being the only two stars in the original twin star that started capturing objects into our solar system, who knows, certainly long, long time ago. But this 4.5 billion year fairy tale that NASA is promoting regarding the solar system, clearly every time they go out there, they find contradictions, so they have to put a little Band-Aid on it here or there, and then it's back to the same old business. So you can see that once again, data comes in, and it has to be a square peg fit in a round hole, but they're going to do it at any cost to save the traditional theories, what I call the axioms of astronomy. And that was a term that it was a kind of a tongue-in-cheek comment that was sent to me in a letter by an editor of a European space science journal back in the when I was at Cornell. I was publishing my papers in European journals at the time because they wouldn't publish them in the U.S. journals. And so I had one published in an English journal, one published in a science journal, astrophysics journal that came out of the Netherlands. And so one of the editors wrote back to me and said that it seems like there is a scientific religious preference in the sciences, and he called them the axioms of astronomy. So I adapted that term and put it in my textbooks or my books that I, especially the Planet X Comets and Earth Changes books. And that's a great term because an axiom is something that you start with as an assumption. And so it's a great term to show exactly what's going on in the world of astronomy. Their assumptions, because nobody was here 4.5 billion years ago to prove that their assumption was correct. And neither at the Big Bang or the beginning of the solar system, I dare say that Carl Sagan or anybody in the astronomy, space science, astrophysics community was around to verify that. So it's certainly an axiom at best. And they keep looking at other star systems and seeing things happening and trying to force fit that concept. But the end result is that there is not a shred of evidence anywhere that that concept is even remotely close to true or even half true. So with that in mind, oh, one other topic. Branson is Richard Branson is going talking about setting up civilizations or groups of people going to Mars. And I like the comment. He was on an interview recently, and he said that, government can't do this. Government can't do space. It's way too expensive. The overhead is too high. And they're not doing it. They're not doing what has to be done. So he's talking about, and I guess next year, they're going to start with space rides. They're going to go up in his, Spaceship 2 and Burt Rutan design, and they're going to go into space. He's also talking about intercontinental flights, just passenger flights, that will be in a few hours, which would use suborbital flight technology. So at any rate, a lot of good things happening in the private industry as far as government science is concerned. It's a waste of time and money. At any rate, on to the main science topic. I'm going to be talking about calendars and what would happen during a pole shift. Now, I kind of started this topic last week, but I want to go deeper into it. And I'm going to start once again by reiterating that a woman wrote in, and she said, I listened to your show, and she said, it's really complicated, and I don't understand it all. And my comment is, good. Neither does just about anybody else understand all the complexities of the solar system. All you have to understand is that, yes, it is complex. But if you track the sun, if you track the stars, and that's relatively easy to do, the ancients did it. They just would put a post in the ground and start tracking it and watch for the cycles and count days, and then they eventually built the more complex calendars. But it's relatively simple to do, and if you have my new calendarization device, then all that work is done for you. And once you start looking at this on a daily basis, then you understand, okay, this is what the sun's doing. Okay, now I understand. I don't understand why it does this, but that's what it's doing. And now, if there were ever a pole shift, the sun would be moving around differently, but you would be able to calculate. You would not in terms of equations or numbers, but you would physically be able to watch the sun moving and the patterns that it goes through. And then, and of course, this is a sun-star clock, so it would produce shadows. And you would track those shadows and rebuild the calendar. But you're not going to be able to do that if you're not familiar with what's going on now. So my point is, what I'm going to describe today is complicated, yes. But all the complication is taken out in the device that I invented, the recalendarization sun-star clock. And it allows you to look at our calendar the way it is today, and both from the point of view of stars and the point of the view of the sun. And now, I made a comment a couple shows ago about the moon not being used for calendarization. Many people have written in saying that after the Moses event, Moses was directed to build a calendar based on the moon. And remember, though, that they were in a very tropical climate. If you're in a very warm climate, say from anywhere from 25 degrees north latitude south to the equator, or if you're in the southern hemisphere, the same thing, from 25 degree latitude down to the equator, in that zone, things are not that important when it comes to the calendarization, because you might have a rainy season, you might have a dry season, but you can grow crops year-round. I know some people around the country are planning on corn, for example, planting, or other crops, and they're going to start planting now. So the issue is that if you're in a far northern climate or a far southern climate, your growing season is much shorter, so calendars and calendarization become much more important relative to harvesting, planting and harvesting. So first of all, that would allow the people, the Israelites who followed Moses, to, in fact, use the moon as a calendar and not be that worried about the sun and the stars. The people who have to worry about the sun and the stars in terms of calendarization are the people in much more northern climates. But also, many, many, many religious and historical events take place and are clocked by the moon, by the cycles of the moon. And so that is true. But once again, when we talk about our calendar, which is the, you know, January, February, March, April, May, June, July, August, September, October, November, December, when we talk about that calendar, the Julian calendar, when we talk about there are months with 30 days, there are months with 31 days, but February has 28 and 29 in leap year, that calendar has nothing to do with the moon. The moon, you could buy a chart, and you, a lot of times when you get a calendar, it'll show the new moon and the quarter moon phases and the half moon phases and the full moon phases, possibly on your calendar. They're listed there. But the moon per se does not, absolutely has zero input into the Julian calendar. The Julian calendar is relative to the stars and the sun. And here's how it works. On a given day of the year, and we usually pick the spring or the fall equinox, and then the solstices, which are the shortest and the longest day in June, around June 21st, we have the longest day of the year. And December 21st, we have the shortest day of the year. The definition of the solstice is where the equatorial plane of Earth, that plane, and then the ecliptic plane where they intersect. And so at any rate, that's the time when the Earth turning has equal days, hours of daylight and nighttime. And of course, since this is changing constantly, that's not even true, but it's kind of an average. But those are the dates we pick. And how are those related to the stars? Well, those positions are fixed relative to the star background. The stars are way far away, and they really don't move. They are actually moving out there, but they move so slowly that in a thousand years, the majority of stars don't move at all relative to the background setting of stars. So they're a very nice reference frame to build a calendar. They're very stable. Earth precesses on its axis like a top. And so our North Pole slowly changes over a 26,000-year period. It's actually 25,000 years and some number of days, but about 26,000-year period. So Earth is changing constantly, and it has changed drastically in the past. So basically, it's the sun, the position of the sun and Earth relative to the background stars that gives us our calendar. So I'm going to go through all of the factors that give us our calendar, and then I'm going to ask the simple question, which of these factors is affected if we have a physical pole shift? That means a big planetary object comes by and causes Earth's axis to flip, physically axis, the axis of Earth flips. So which of these factors are going to change? And the answer is that all of them change. All of them change in possibly the orbits of other planets. We know, for example, that Mars had a very different orbit, and Earth probably had a very different orbit prior to the last serious pole shift. That was when the mastodons, the saber-toothed tiger, the woolly mammoths, and that crew of animals went under. These were very big animals, and they required, they evolved, of course, over a long period of time, and they became very large and demanded very large food amounts of food on a daily basis. So when that food supply was cut short, and they just couldn't survive, so they died worldwide. They literally went extinct. So those animals are no longer on Earth, and that was within the last 10,000 years. And a lot of people put that as early as or as late as 4,500 years ago. In the transition of the Holocene period. And that's when a lot of volcanoes, a lot of earth changes were going on at the same time. But modern science does its best to deny all of that. They simply deny it. They say that no, none of that happened. And the dinosaurs, or the dinosaurs, the mastodons, just died because, they just died. They just died. They just died in those 50-foot embankments of ice and snow in Siberia while they were eating tropical plants. Isn't that interesting? So anyway, back to the factors of Earth's rotation. Okay, so Earth rotates on its axis. That's one factor. And as I go through all of these factors, understand that they are independent. Each one is its own clocking system, independent of all the rest. And so when we put these together, we start combining them, we really only use two or three of these factors to build our calendar. And then all of the rest of them are adjustments. So the spin rate of the Earth on its axis, that's what we call a day. Now there's a star day, so the Earth spins around, comes back exactly one complete revolution, 360 degrees, and that's relative to the background stars, those stars that are way out there. That is a star day. Okay, relative to the sun, we are orbiting the sun, so as we spin around and then move in our orbit, the Earth has to turn just a little bit more than a star day to allow the sun to appear at the same point in the sky, its highest point in the sky. And that position changes relative to the background stars every day of the year. Every time we spin around, the sun is in a different spot as far as the background stars are concerned. So the ancient Babylonians divided this into 12 divisions and called it the zodiac. So we have the 12 constellations of the zodiac. And like I said before, a lot of people think of the zodiac like, oh, that's voodoo science, that's astrology. No, it's just the basis of our calendar. That's the basis of the Julian calendar. So we have three factors really that build our calendar, the primary factors. It's the spin rate of the Earth, the moving of Earth around in its orbit, and the changing of the position of the sun on a daily basis as we move around the orbit of the sun. So our view of the sun is on a daily basis changing relative to the background stars, and that gives us our zodiac. The 12 months, and then you could divide that up into all kinds of divisions. You could divide it into 18 months. You could divide it into 6 months. There's nothing magical about 12. But that's what somebody did way back when, and they solidified that into the Julian calendar, 43 BC. I'm going to repeat an interesting fact about the Julian calendar. When they created it, they extrapolated it back to around 4300 BC. And now that's a very interesting thing to do. Why would you extrapolate a calendar back thousands of years? It has no practical purpose. Because there's just no real reason to do that unless you were trying to destroy the concept that calendar had changed. In fact, it brings up a point. Why would you even have to create a calendar? Wouldn't it have been created long ago if, in fact, the Earth had a stable orbit for all those thousands of years? And, of course, the moot point is that no, Earth did not have a stable orbit and it changed due to the interaction with the comet Venus that came through the solar system, interacted with Earth on two occasions, changed the calendar, changed all of these factors, And so, okay, back to the factors in the calendar. The Earth's orbit around the Sun is one of the factors. The spin rate of the Earth is another factor. Okay, now let's look at the Earth's orbit. It's elliptical. It's not a perfect circle. It's not very elliptical. It's almost a perfect circle. But at some points in its orbit, it's farther than the Sun. I think about a little bit more than 152,000 kilometers. And then at its closest position to the Sun, it's about 147,000 kilometers. So that's a swing of about 5 million. Let me go back and say that again. It's 147 million kilometers from the Sun at its closest position. It's 152 and a little bit million kilometers from the Sun at its farthest point. And so that's a spread of about 5 million kilometers. Doesn't sound like much in terms of outer space, but it's enough to cause the Earth to move a little slower when it's farther away and a little faster when it's closer. So the Sun day varies. The star day doesn't vary. The star day stays the same. The only variation in the star day is due to the precession of Earth like a top. If you take a top in a kid's toy, you put a string on it and you throw it on the floor and it's spinning around, it's going to precess. And everybody has seen a top precessing, I hope. And so it's doing that because there's an object spinning in a gravitational field. It's one of the effects. And so the precession, the Earth is doing that in both the Moon and Sun gravitational field. And so it's going to precess on about a 26,000 year period. And so that means that even though the spin rate of the Earth is not changing, the direction that the spin axis is pointing is changing. So as we, in the Sun-Star calendar, I have all of this information codified there, and so you can see, for example, just by looking very precisely at where the north spin axis of the Earth is, and the calendar allows you to do this, you can tell the year simply by seeing where the spin axis is relative to the North Star. And all of this data, like I say, is on the recalendering device. And so at any rate, these are all factors that change our calendar slightly. Now, Earth spins around 365 and a quarter days in 1 year. So you can see that there's a quarter extra day. Earth does not spin around a perfect 365 times in 1 year. And it would be very unusual for that to happen. There's no reason why Earth should spin a perfect number of revolutions in a particular year. In fact, as you get down to very exact measurements, it would be very unlikely. Or let's talk about the Moon a little bit. The Moon has an approximate 28-day cycle. And so that doesn't match with the Earth revolutions. It doesn't match with the Earth orbit. Doesn't have anything to do with the stars or the spinning of the Earth. So that's another factor that is basically out of sync with everything else. The Moon's orbit is 28 days, and so a lot of people think that the Moon is relative to the months, the same number of, say, new moons, but as the number of months in the year, and it's really not true. The Moon has a 28-day cycle. Our months have a 30 and 31-day cycle. So how is the Moon going to be synced with the months of the year? It's simply not. So at any rate, the lunar calendar, the dates that are specified due to the Moon are basically like I say, it's a ceremonial or religious or historical counting. And sure, you could build a calendar based on the Moon, but it wouldn't give you the things that are important in your life. The planting season, for example. You would have to be constantly adjusting a lunar calendar to account for the planting season and when to harvest. Those are the things your life depends on. Those are the things that depend on the solar calendar. When is it springtime? When is it fall? When do you plant? When do you harvest? It doesn't depend on where the moon is. Although, I should say this, that many people, many farmers, plant by the moon. And there's some, there's a lot of empirical evidence to suggest that the moon, in fact, influences how plants grow, when the seeds sprout, things like that. There are things that go on. And it's, I would say, it's poorly understood by science. But there's clearly something going on. There's something relative to the moon. A study was done of sheriffs all over the country. And they asked them, when is the time of most violence and most crimes? They without doubt said, it's the full moon. So that people kind of go a little crazy. There's something to that werewolf, possibly in, who knows, in all of us. But certainly some people go off the deep end during the full moon, and most sheriffs will say all of their statistics show that during the full moon, everything, all the crime rates, everything goes up. And so they're just happy when the full moon is over because they can get back to normal, whatever that is, for the next month. So at any rate, let's look at the orbits of other planets. Mars had a very different orbit. Earth had a very different orbit before the Venus event. And so the calendar of Mars, if you had a Mars calendar, it would obviously have changed. And this is one of the benefits of the recalendarization device, is I give all of the data to reconstruct our current calendar, not only the calendar, but how that calendar was built in the orbit, and reconstruct our orbit relative to the stars, relative to the background stars, and how does that, so if archaeologists ever discovered this, one of these plates in the future, thousands of years from now, they would be able to piece together our calendar, something that we do not have the benefit when we look back at ancient civilizations. So at any rate, next week I'll be taking up some new topics, so this kind of concludes the topic of calendars. But just go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, that's seven letters, short for jmccsci.com, but jmccsci.com. And the recalendar device are $39.95 plus $5 shipping, or if you buy two of them, you get free shipping. Or if you buy $200 worth of any combination of products, you get one free. And so it's something that I believe everybody needs, and I'm very proud of this little product, as you might be able to tell from my shows. It's something that does not exist anyplace else, only found on my webpage. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.